our last lesson with our attempt to understand what is continuum of thought. You remember it, yes? Citta Santana. What is about? It's a very strange notion because it borders on something but individual. One continuum of thought, yes, called Andrew. Another continuum of thought called me, called Alexander, etc., etc., etc. And it is a very difficult notion, first of all, because it is beginningless, and but it has its end. Where? In Nirvana. Because there is no thought in Nirvana. There is no mind in Nirvana. There is no consciousness in Nirvana. Because it would be incorrect to say that, as usually is presented in the Buddhist manuals in China, Tibet, and Central Asia and North India, to again villagers and town folk, well, there will be no suffering in Nirvana. But it is for us, the simple people. Because, let me remind you, we are returning two lessons before, yes, that suffering is, first of all, my awareness of suffering, yes. That is the beginning of Buddhism. But that is why it is very interesting. The end of Buddhist philosophy, and later the end of the final purpose of Buddhist religion too, is freedom from suffering. And of course, what comes to mind, it is a great word, I told you already, yes, uttered by probably the last really interesting, remarkable philosopher in European tradition, Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, freedom, freedom? Again, freedom from what? Don't ask freedom from what? Ask freedom for what? In Buddhism too, the idea of freedom was in the first place a positive idea for the highest understanding of all that there is. I think that at that moment Nietzsche was as it were Buddhist, because he understood perfectly well. He understood perfectly well that incompleteness of our idea of freedom. Okay, you got it, yes. What are you going to do with it? Yes? Oh, yes. Drink again, watch television again, yes. Be happy, yes. In your own totally unenlightened way again. Splendid freedom, yes. Freedom with cars, yes, with idiotic conversations, with doing nothing, yes, and with becoming more and more ignorant. And that is why we have an additional explanation given by Buddha in quite a few early sources in Pali language. Freedom is necessary. It is absolutely necessary, but only for those who know what to do with that freedom. Never remember what I always, well, when I'm speaking about these things, I remember to sayings, to great sayings. One was what said one of the closest friends and followers of Hitler, Ernst Röhm, later killed, of course, by Hitler, of course. Yes. He said, now we at the last are free to do what we want to do. That is to drink, to kill, to murder, etc., etc., etc. Due to our Führer, due to Hitler. Yes. And the other, so again, even here, it is freedom to do something without any knowledge of what you are doing, free or unfree. And absolutely the same slogan was expressed by one of the closest aides of Joseph Stalin, who said at the Party Congress in 1939, at last we are free from all our internal enemies. It is after they killed approximately a couple of million people. Yes, we are free. And now we may start anon. Yes, anew. Our new, always young and happy life. It was brilliantly said, you know. I like when people are sincere, yes. Yes, no monkey business, yes. So, enough with freedom for the time being with the church. So, we'll return to it. But the problem with Nirvana is that Nirvana is thought about in the Buddhist philosophy. In the first place, not in terms of minuses, no individual consciousness, yes, no suffering, but far more important would be to look at the idea of Nirvana from the point of view of some positive content, and in its positive sense. And so we are coming. We start our transition from thought and from Buddhist philosophy of thought to Buddhist philosophy of knowledge. And Nirvana is described at the same time as equal to the highest state of knowledge. Knowledge of everything. So we may call it that kind of knowledge absolute knowledge. And that is why Buddha is very often called omniscient, because his knowledge was absolute. Absolute not only in general, but also in each and every particular instance. Yes, please.
I get a little confused about the conception of the Buddha's omniscience and the Buddha's perfection to be taken literally. Or is it...
You're asking about what I think about that, or what about they thought about that?
Well, I was just wondering if it's ever really a question.
You know, again, it in some of the Buddhist schools, it was an issue and very important one. When I say in schools, because what? Only when discussion starts, philosophical discussion, a lot of questions can be what raised. In our common life, we simply do not raise questions, yes. Apart from, well, those concerning what is at hand, yes. But you know, your question I can reduce to sort of whether it was a kind of philosophical truth or a kind of myth? Yes, that's what you are asking. But ladies and gentlemen, now try to understand not the Buddha, but poor me. Because from the point of view of philosophical research, myth is not opposed to scientific knowledge. And truth expressed in terms of mythology is not by itself opposed to the truth opposed to based on the position of mythology to science, for instance. That is why one of the greatest men of the 20th century, Albert Einstein, used to repeat, by the way, he liked very much the word myth. He used to repeat as if he were a Buddhist. Oh well, it would be very interesting to see whether really the velocity of light is an absolute truth, and or it is a myth. And then he, always smiling, sometimes laughing, yes, commented upon his own words, adding, I may say that as far as I know, Newton's law of gravitation is truth, and the constant c, velocity of light, is scientific truth. But if you ask me whether the world is what? Infinite or not? Whether the universe had or did not have its beginning, or whether it will or will not have its end? Einstein said, that is not science. These questions pertain to mythology, because they cannot be proved or disproved scientifically. In fact, our common language is full of mythology. We simply do not realize it, yes? It's full of mythology. And most of the slogans, yes?
You can finish if you want.
No, yes, please.
It seems the idea of absolute knowledge is...
is what?
Contrary to Buddhist thought.
Undoubtedly. So it must be taken, that idea, as your colleague quite rightly suggested, as something mythical. As something mythical. And later on, in the Mahayana philosophical schools, all those mythical concepts were analyzed. And very often completely either suspended or completely destroyed. And well, as an example of this is, first of all, it is the myth of uniqueness of events and uniqueness of persons. That is what Buddha himself and his philosophical followers considered a sheer myth. And that is why in the later Mahayana, and first of all in the Tantrist philosophical schools, it was said, oh, the great Buddha, the great community of his pupils, ascetics, the great truth of Dharma. But never forget, as Kedupche, the greatest Tibetan Buddhist philosopher, used to repeat, that there were infinite number of Buddhas, infinite number of communities, and infinite number of final truths manifested in the Buddhist teaching of Dharma, yes. In each Buddhist philosophical school, there was a never-ending struggle between, let me call it, relativists and finalists. No, everything has its end. Everything has its beginning. While relativists, well, retorted, well, billions of beginnings, billions of ends, etc., etc. But let me now return for the last time now, before interval, to Nirvana. The notion of Nirvana from the very start was made indeed philosophical, not simply a kind of paradise, yes. Though undoubtedly it also has its mythological features that we already said that in the context of the law of interdependent origination, that the phenomenon of suffering by which each and every dharma is marked is contingent upon, in the final analysis, ignorance. But then, again, philosophically, we may start asking, whose ignorance? And that is why, in order even to begin to understand Buddhist philosophy, you must understand absolute superfluity, irrelevance of the question whose. Because though formally it is, as it were, suffering of all what? Sentient beings. That is, of all beings having at least what? One organ of senses. But we may say that it is in the context of broader philosophical approach, this phenomenon of suffering as of ignorance, you know, is universal in the first place and is objective. Because in our everyday language, both suffering and ignorance are the terms that mark our subjectivity. I may say, of course, I am ignorant, but in comparison with Mr. X, I am a genius, yes. And the same can Mr. X say, well, of course I am suffering, but in comparison with John, I'm the happiest man in the world. Ad infinitum, you understand that? And that is why it is absolutely essential to understand. And that is why. That is why these two words, ignorance and suffering, were torn out of the context of everyday language in Buddhism and endowed with philosophical meaning as the links in the law of interdependent origination. It is indeed very, very essential. And finally, we are coming, speaking of Nirvana, we are coming again to the notion of the highest knowledge in Buddhist prajna, with its essential elements. The most essential element is the law of interdependent origination. Prajna. You know, again, the word is absolutely Indo-European. Pra, you know, as common Indo-European prefix, yes, before or intensifying or what? And jnana is what? No, the same root. Cognoscere, gnosko, yes. And in ancient Greek, in Lithuanian, in Latin, and in Sanskrit, the root, that is the root JN, yes, to know. Prajna means literally, if we try to render it into English, literally it is, as it were, re-knowledge, re-knowing, again, knowing again and again, where prefix re will be again and again, as in the English about retorting, restating, yes, etc., etc. So prajna is re-knowledge, re-knowing, in the sense that which is absolutely obvious to everybody, you are rethinking and re-knowing it. For instance, there is a common knowledge, yes, shared by you, I'm sure, and by me, common vulgar knowledge, because each and every common knowledge is vulgar. To be happy is good, to be suffering is bad, yes. Whereas, as one of the Buddhist scholars said, for a normal man, it is impossible even to start understanding suffering without what? Being suffering himself. Because we need to sensually experience suffering. With exception of whom? Of some very, very few geniuses who even without any suffering know everything, any personal suffering. They know everything about suffering. They intuit it, yes?
Would that include those who've reached nirvana?
Sorry?
Would those include people who have reached nirvana?
Which what?
Who have reached nirvana, since in nirvana there is no suffering?
Oh, no, the thing is, well, at a very pertinent question, there can be no any communication from nirvana, at least within the framework of the early Buddhist philosophy, because nirvana is a kind of different dimension of the universe. Yes, please.
If life is suffering, then how are there those special people that can understand everything?
Oh, well, a good question again. Do follow them, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, these two gentlemen. Yes, it is very interesting. Because those very few persons, well, by the way, let us call them geniuses, they may know something without any experience, without any experiencing them. You know about such phenomena, yes? They are very, very few and far between, yes. And they were called in Sanskrit Svayambhu, self-born, self-being, self-existing. But you know, it is not only sheer mythology, yes. Because even within the framework of our so-called, in double quotes, Western culture, we have such people, yes. And there is another term by which they were denoted in the early historical Buddhism. First of all, they were called geniuses medavin in Sanskrit, medavin. But secondly, they were called achaiksha, that is, non-taught. Because there was no reason to teach them, yes. It was impossible to teach them, at least in a particular concrete discipline. You know, let me give you two examples. One example is the 19th century, when a young Indian boy Ramanujan by name. All mathematicians know him, yes. Yes?
I saw Goodwill Hunting.
Sorry?
I saw Goodwill Hunting. Mentioned him.
Ramanujan came to Cambridge, I forgot, or Oxford now. And by the word announced that he knows all the properties of what?
Man.
Of all numbers. Of all numbers. And they started what? In Cambridge. Testing him, yes? God. It was an unimaginable day in Cambridge. Six mathematicians. And they started at random writing one number, another number, etc., etc., etc. And one chap wrote the number 11 billions, 6 millions, 400,013. And then Indian chap produced the pencil and said, oh, well, it's very simple. This number is divided into that, etc., etc., etc. It also has such and such way. It was supernatural knowledge. He was born with it. And some elements of such knowledge were observed in quite a few other people in America, by the way, and in England, yes, and in Europe, yes. Yes?
What is the cause of supernatural intelligence that you're born with?
Oh, yes, such is one of the Buddhist explanations. That such people, they, as it were taught in one of their previous reincarnations. But it is only one of the explanations, because in some other schools of Buddhist philosophy, it was denied vehemently. No. Why? Because from the point of view of some other schools, such phenomenon cannot be asked because of what and why. Because in some schools such a phenomenon was considered what? Unconditioned. That is, without cause and effect, that is not subject to what? To the law of interdependent origination. And so, we are returning to Nirvana. The most essential thing about Nirvana is that Nirvana has no cause, no roots. And Nirvana itself does not produce any causes, is no cause itself, and does not produce any effects, because it is unconditioned. Like in some instances, the phenomena of that supernatural knowledge. Yes. Yes.
Nirvana, by its existence, by our knowledge of it, whatever little knowledge we have, isn't that an
Do revert your remark, which I like very much. Do revert it now.
Okay. You said Nirvana doesn't produce any effects.
Yes. And has no causes.
Yes.
Which Nirvana, but that attempt to reach its goal, way or path. Yes. In Buddhism. As we see it in the Fourth Noble Truth, it is the way, but again, that attempt is not the cause of Nirvana, because you may attempt, you may be attempting for billions of your reincarnations, and now, yes, and no Nirvana, because Nirvana is not conditioned by your seriousness, by your efforts. It is not conditioned by anything. And some geniuses, some in Sanskrit svayambhus, may reach Nirvana. As even the Buddha himself remarked on more than one occasion, in a moment by chance. How come? How can it be? Simply on the strength of the principle that Nirvana is absolutely unconditioned. Neither by objective facts, nor by individual efforts or thoughts or knowledges. And of course you may again ask me whether this such a notion of nirvana can be regarded as mythological. And then my answer will be very, very simple. The opposition of mythology to logic or to science is very artificial opposition. It is made by ourselves. Because we are unable to observe in our thinking, in our speaking, and in our doings the mixture of logic with mythology, of science with fiction. Mythology as well as science, they do not exist in as a sort of pure entities. You understand that? Otherwise, each and every scientific notion may be arbitrarily qualified as mythological, and very often such is the case. And by the way, not infrequently, some myths happen to become scientific truths. Again. But this idea of nirvana is absolutely unconditioned and non-causal. That is very important for our understanding of Buddhist philosophy. At the same time, the very phenomenon of Buddha or Buddhas in plural, yes, is also unconditioned and non-causal. Though, of course, at a certain stage we may consider the whole life of Buddha, the whole life in terms of one phase or one stage producing the next stage, producing the third stage, etc. But strictly Buddhistically, there can be no logic, no causality as regards the Buddha's circumstances or life, or lives, if speaking of his previous, speaking of his previous lives. But as Edward Conze insists in his book, A Buddhist Thought in India, hitherto the best book on the subject in the world, as he insists, probably the main thing very often overlooked by those who want to know Buddhist philosophy, one of the main things in it is that the appearance of the idea, not of suffering, but the appearance of the idea of the unconditioned, of a special kind of beings, Buddhas, who are unlike I and you, unlike me and you, totally unconditioned. Yes. By the way, it is very interesting to make such an elementary mental experiment. Open any newspaper, yes, on any page, yes, say Herald Tribune International or New York Post or anything, and it would be enough for you to read a couple of sentences, and they will contain a reference to one or another cause, yes. Because not only are we living in the conditioned world and are conditioned ourselves, but all our speech, all our writings, all our thoughts are conditioned and cannot get used to the idea of the unconditioned. That is, to the idea of Nirvana, to the idea of the Buddha, to the idea of the highest knowledge. 2 minutes interval, yes. By the way, interval for me is one thing, interval for you is quite another thing. Yes, sir. For me it is for smoking, for you it is for thinking. Yes, okay?